I'm Hal Eisner, and this is What the Hal. Now, I'm going to be pretty serious about this because this is a subject that really kind of upsets me in many ways. And it's not something that I think can be taken lightly. We're talking about the state of hate in 2018. It's really high. There's all kinds of hate coming out of hidden places, it almost feels like. And those who are of minority groups, those who are sometimes victims of hate crimes, those who are people that could be victimized are fully aware of how tense and how uncomfortable the environment has become when it comes to hate. We have guests for this podcast that understand the problem, want to do something about the problem, are doing something about the problem, and honestly, they're a good voice for the people that they represent. Right now, the state of hate in 2018. With us right now, Pastor Edgar Boyd of the First AME Church, Anila Ali, who I'm going to let you describe your organization when you get a chance to talk here, because it's a mouthful.
I know.
And also with us, Adam Buska and Jeff Parsley, who were the founders of the No Hate campaign, and I've been very impressed with that over the years. Also, Brian Levin, who is a professor at Cal State San Bernardino, or is it UC San Bernardino? Cal State, right? Okay. I get these UCs and these Cal State. Oh, what the hell, right? So let me ask you. I mean, we're talking in this podcast about hate. And let me just go around the circle here and ask you to give us sort of your size up of the state of hate in 2018. We'll start with Brian.
Well, it's really interesting. We're below the record levels that we saw after 2001, but it's affected different localities and different communities differently. We bottomed out in 2014, and we've been up ever since. But give you an example. Hate crime against Muslims nearly doubled. And in various cities, it shakes up who's the number one target. So in New York City, Jews are the number one target. Nationally, African Americans are. And for instance, in Washington, D.C. oftentimes, and San Francisco and Seattle, we're seeing the LGBTQ community targeted the most. So when we talk about hate, I think one of the things we have to look at is what community are we talking about? And also, we're not only talking about crimes, we're talking about these public manifestations of hate, which we've all seen on television here locally, but also we've seen, and listen to this, we've seen more mega rallies, I mean rallies of 100 or more white supremacists or white nationalists in the last 2 years than in the previous 10 to 20. But post-Charlottesville, that orbit has cracked and that white nationalist community is now fragmented yet again.
Anila, your group is in Orange County.
It is.
And it is called?
American Muslim Multifaith Women's Empowerment Council. And we used to be just Muslim women wanting to engage and empower women. But we had a lot of our Jewish friends join us. And then we had our Christian friends say, we want to be a part of it. And so we had to add that multifaith to be inclusive.
You're the founder of this, and I'm wondering why you thought it was necessary to do that.
It was important because there were lots of misconceptions about Muslim women, and I felt that my community is going to be left behind. If Muslim women don't go out there since, 9/11, I feel Muslim women have a better hold on how they're going to raise kids. And yes, radicalization has been an issue. And if we are better informed, we're engaged, and, we're giving back to the country that we live in, I think we'll be better citizens. And that's why we came forward and said, okay, we're going to have this unity.
Edgar Boyd is the senior pastor at the First AME Church. And I've been to your church many times, and I like your church. It's a fantastic place. And also, I understand you're doing a lot of things to bring various groups together in your church. So as you explain a little bit about that, I want to get your size up on how you describe the state of hate in 2018.
Thank you. Yeah, we look at hate and understand that it is learned behavior. and the mind being what it is, it can actually, if it can learn to hate, it can also learn to love and to include and to embrace and to help to bring to the fore a better environment. Because the environment has taught us in the last few years that the proliferation of expressions of hate has been fueled by the environment. All of the elements seem to have come together, like the stars are aligning in the planet to provide ways for people to express themselves in hate-filled ways. So the whole idea and the whole opportunity has been taken advantage of by our congregation in reaching out across the lines. We work diligently with the Jewish community, Temple Isaiah, across town from us. We do three or four things every year to bring these two congregations together around conversations about what can be done to eliminate hate and to rise the awareness and to raise the awareness histories, of identities, of cultures, of understandings, and move away from the misunderstanding so we can become a little bit more knowledgeable of each other. Because I believe what really creates hate is misunderstanding, is selfishness, is greed, and it's also the ignorance that always comes in and rears its ugly head.
It's the notion that we're not born to hate, we learn to hate. And let me ask Jeff and Adam, first of all, I want to ask you about your No Hate campaign. Now, for those who aren't familiar, this was a campaign to visually draw people into becoming anti-hate.
Well, the campaign started after Proposition 8 passed here in California, which banned same-sex marriage. Adam and I were taking part in the rallies and protests throughout West Hollywood and Hollywood, and we felt like there was such an energy and a powerful message coming from the streets, from the people, and we wanted to try to see if there was a way that we could portray that same message and create that vibe through a photo, because social media is important in everybody's lives, and so we thought that a profile photo could spark dialogue, and so we decided to put the tape on our mouth because we felt like we were silenced. We felt like California was putting our right as a minority group up to a vote, so that our voices were not going to be heard through that vote.
But you didn't just do profile pictures. You did pictures with people wearing stickers on their faces that say N-O-H-8, which is no hate.
Because Proposition 8 was labeled Proposition Hate, because it was directly writing discrimination into the Constitution of California. So it was labeled as Proposition Hate. So we felt like we were being the victims of that hate. So we wanted to try to send the message of no hate.
And the year that started was what?
That was in 2009, after the passage of Proposition 8.
All right, so we're 9 years down the road. How effective has it been?
For us, it started in response to the passage of marriage equality, or the banning of marriage equality. But for these days, we've seen people come forth wanting to speak out to a variety of issues, whether it's race, sexual orientation, religion. We have so many different reasons that we're different, but this shouldn't be the dividing factor. We should be celebrating our differences, and we should be sharing our stories and educating to each other that these are, it's not the opposition. These are your neighbors. These are your friends. This is your family. So it's all about creating visibility and putting a face to the issue.
And your effort has expanded outside of the gay lesbian community, right?
Correct. I mean, if not even, it's expanded worldwide. We've been to 23 different countries, and we want to show how, whether it's for same-sex adoption or whether it's the transgender military ban, there's so many different issues that this affects, and just by sharing your story and sharing your visibility, we can make a difference.
Hate is all too relevant, I think, and nowadays, with the amount of visibility that hateful speech has and the platform that some people have that speak hatefully, it's just so relevant to all of us that we can all get behind the message of supporting no hate.
I suspect after 9 years, you can look back over the last nine and chart what you've seen in the way of hate increases, hate decreases. What have you seen?
We've seen a rise in involvement. I mean, even in this past political season, we've seen a spike of people wanting to make a statement. When we see in some of the more repressed areas that people want to make that statement and they want to be heard. So we want to be that platform for people. We want to allow everyone to make a statement because everyone deserves to be heard.
And you have your statistics saying that hate crimes are on a rise doubly over the last 2 years. Transgender folks are the most most hate crimes are towards transgender people. We have to remember that the administration that we have in office right now is writing discrimination against transgender people at this moment into law. So the fact that that's happening is because it's being publicly done on such a level that our government is writing this into the laws, into our Constitution.
And so that empowers those who believe that it's okay to hate.
Yeah. It's not necessarily the fact that maybe there's more haters. It's the fact that people are now more comfortable being vocal about it.
Where did you come up with the idea of the no hate tattoo?
We initially saw people using the Victim of Hate logo online to show their support for this issue, to speak out against discrimination. But being a photographer, it was important to show who is supporting the issue and who is being discriminated against. We want people to look into the eyes of these subjects and essentially know the people. This is a human issue. See the people they're affecting.
Am I right or am I wrong? It seems to me that that one device really, everybody coalesced around that one device. That thing was what made the campaign effective.
I think photography is a powerful tool, and I think imagery and putting a face to the issue is important, but I think also calling it hate and calling it what it is also a very important thing. A lot of people have an uncomfortable time essentially putting that name to the term, but essentially calling it what it is and having that discussion, it's a start. That's a start.
Well, I mean, it's important to do that. I mean, hate is not okay. And you know, it's okay to dislike something or somebody. It's okay to, that's not my cup of tea, you know, but it's not okay to hate, to make somebody feel small, to hurt somebody, to put them in a position where they feel discriminated against. And I guess that's the point that I drive home, right? That I feel as I see hate around me. Pastor, let me ask you, what is it that you think about that?
Yeah, it's really all about environment, how people feel comfortable in expressing their ignorance, and expressing their misunderstanding or their lack of understanding, how people feel comfortable about reaching out, inflicting pain onto another based upon their gender, based upon their sexual orientation, based upon their ethnicity, their race, or their being included, or their being excluded, about their being an immigrant, or their being a citizen, or their being economically empowered, or being unempowered, or being homeless or well-housed. We create through our speech, we create through the things that we endorse and embrace, an atmosphere for hate to proliferate. And until we turn that around, until we start attacking the system, start attacking the environment and cleaning it up, and when we do that, I believe hate then will begin to move, because we'll have no more of a habitat, because it will be starved to death. It will be thirsted to death. It can no longer survive. Rodney King, all of us know and remember him.
Can't we all get along?
Can't we all just get along? And I believe when we start to do things that help to bring us together, we'll be much stronger, united, than we ever could be separate.
It's amazing how many times I've quoted him. Of course, just as a side mention here, I actually interviewed him in jail a long time ago when he was arrested and when that whole thing was going on.
Right.
But that one little line has resonated so powerfully over the years. Can't we just all get along?
Isn't that true?
Yeah. Anila?
You know, I think that the four-letter word hate needs to be eliminated from our vocabulary. My grandfather he saw the Holocaust. He lived through the partition of India and Pakistan. We lost everything. And he would always say, don't hate broccoli or peas. Don't use that word.
What if you don't love broccoli or peas?
You just have to say, I'd rather have something else.
or as my kids might say today, that's good. I'm good. I'm okay. Right?
Yeah. And, you know, I didn't understand that for the longest time. It's only until I met a Holocaust survivor who came to my school. And he told me, do you know that the worst word in the English vocabulary is hate? And that's where hate starts. And in my work with the council, we try to find other ways to say we don't like this, and we build bridges across cultures. And if we don't know someone, we want to make sure that we get out there and we get to know them, because it is through that interaction, the human, the interaction, bringing humanity to a group of people, humanizing them, that we can get rid of hate in the world.
The thing that strikes me is that, and I'm not going to give away my age, but I'm no spring chicken. You know, I thought by the time I got to be at the age I'm at now, that things would be better. I thought all these issues of people conditions and people not getting along and political strife and all, I thought we'd figure that all out by the time I got to be an adult. And it just seems to have gone the other way. Brian?
Really interesting. You know, they say history doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes. You know, we're seeing a fragmentation in this society, and we saw it with some of the research, and it's not just with respect to race and religion. Our Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at Cal State did some research showing that in California, we saw violent public demonstrations double in a year. As I said, we saw November 2016, the election time, the worst November ever, and breaking a trend that we've seen with regard to increases during election years. Bottom line, though, hate crimes are actually lower. In California, we had 2,000 hate crimes in 2001. We're below 1,931, even with the back-to-back increases. So we have double increases going on, which we haven't seen in over a dozen years. But here's what I think is happening. I think public incivility, and we've seen it, as we've said, on the television where people are out there saying, you know, I don't want people from X countries, or I don't like gay people, saying this in public. And that's something that I think is very interesting. So hate crimes you can look at and all that, but I think the social surveys indicate that we're fragmented, we're splintered, and one of the things that social media has done, unfortunately, is fragment us even more. Because one quick thing, because the institutions that used to hold us together, the press, academia, the church, trust has plummeted, and government. So now social media has allowed an echo chamber to take place where the churches, the public parks, and the schoolyards used to be where we could get along.
I want to talk about social media for a second. I have gotten to a point where people start being hateful, they get kicked off my island. And if they use a word that I think is not okay, they get kicked off my island. And that's because I have young people that follow me along as well as older folks. And I don't want to be somebody who is purveying hate or hateful speech or things that aren't okay and have younger people pick it up. And I feel like we're each responsible for our own social media. And, you know, you can have an account, and if you don't monitor that account, who knows what's going to end up on there and how people are going to purvey their feelings. There's something about anonymity on social media. And, you know, you don't know who that person really is. They put a name to themselves, but you don't know who they are. You don't know if they're a man or a woman or whatever. You just simply don't know what you're dealing with. And so Facebook or Instagram or any of these things, while they have very redeeming values, and there's a lot I like about them, there's also this one thing that is hard to control, and that's when people want to be hateful. And that's I think, and let's follow up with a couple of other answers. I think that's where we're responsible for our own accounts, to make sure that those people that do want to be hateful, who do want to spread that political divide, are no longer on our accounts, if that's not something we believe in. You buy that?
Absolutely. And interestingly enough, I was just in Europe and we were talking about this very thing. Here's what's happening, though. The social media universe is going to look different 10 or 15 years from now. And what it's going to be is more fragmented, just as we've seen with regard to broadcast television, then breaking into cable and everything else. So what we have a conundrum, and that is, as the over-the-top haters get kind of knocked off, they're migrating now to more libertarian platforms like VK, the Russian Facebook. So the question is, do we want these folks to be segregated yet have their own community, which is what's happening, or do we want to try to empower more dialogue? These over-the-top folks, you're not going to be able to do that. But the wobblers, maybe we can.
This is like bullying, though. If you stand up to somebody who tries to bully you, they stand down.
Amen.
And so that applies to social media, right?
I'm a big fan of social media. I feel like as a Muslim combating Islamophobia, I do want to speak to people who don't know Muslims, and that's my only platform. And I've seen people's hearts and minds change and melt and say, okay, you might be a Muslim who's not violent, and that's fine, and they'll back off.
I want to bring up a bit of history here because I've known Anila for a very long time. And you, when we first met, you had a book.
Yes.
And the book was called?
Mommy, M-I-A, and the missing word is terrorists.
Mm-hmm. And why did you write that book?
Well, my daughter was in grade 3, and she was sharing her, you know, she's born in Saudi Arabia, she has some Pakistani parents, and just then a young little boy got up and he called her terrorist. And, you know, how did we deal with that and what happened? And we realized, you know, it wasn't the kid's fault. It was nothing. It was just ignorance. And we need to get out there and meet this family.
Has that book had an impact?
It has, not in the way that we really wanted. It is an interfaith book. And my Jewish friends and my Christian colleagues came forward. Anila, what can we do for you? And we do use it in our curriculum. And I try to, you know, give lesson plans to people who call me and say, okay, a kid got name called terrorist. But I feel like that whole issue, the reason why we wrote it, I think it's happening in classrooms a lot more. And what is sad is what I'm hearing from Muslim kids who are saying, it's okay, I get called terrorist all the time. I'm used to it.
Yeah, but you know what? That is a very disturbing image of a child saying, "Mommy, am I a terrorist? Mommy, am I bad? Mommy, am I something wrong with me?" I mean, that's a terrible thing for a child to have to go through. I mean, what child should ever have to feel that they're a terrorist?
Absolutely correct. Dr. Maya Angelou, in a poem on the Pulse of Morning, says in the middle of the poem, "You may stand upon my back and face your most distant fears and opportunities." But she said, "Do not hide your face." When we look at public media, social media, when we look at Instagram and when we look at Twitter and we look at Facebook, the way we communicate, that is a powerful tool that helps us to communicate in ways now in almost galactic speed in comparison to what we did 10, 15, 20 years ago. So utilizing that is strong. But to have a child to be vulnerabilized, to be exposed to expressions of hate to the point that they become victimized by what is being transmitted through and via public media, I think is one of the biggest dangers that we can ever expose that child to because it taints their minds.
It does. And let's go back to that notion that we're born pure, but we learn hate. And if as a young child we're beginning to learn and all of a sudden we're painted as somebody that's bad in some way or another, that just exacerbates the problem. And as you get older, unless you have some way to vent or to understand what the problem is, it's going to affect you as an adult, right?
I think it can be summed up to say that words matter, regardless of who you are, whether you're the leader of this nation or you're just someone with an influence over your friends and family. Your words matter and your actions matter.
Jeff, Adam, Pastor, I think the point being that we all have a responsibility, right?
Precisely. Every one of us has a responsibility to take a stand. Robert Kennedy said, "Some people see things as they are and ask why." And he said, "Real people dream of things as they ought to be and ask why not." So I think we are part of the why not generation. We must bring to the fore the answers, the solutions, the problems from our own vantage point, looking through the lens of our own experiences and saying, what can I do to help to bring about a change? What can I do to overcome the hatred that I see from day to day? What can I do by way of communication to help my next generation to learn from the failures and from the advances that I've been a part of?
So let's pause for 1 second, and I want you to say that Robert Kennedy quote again, because it's one of my favorite Robert Kennedy quotes, and I think it says a lot. Let's listen to those words again. You want to say that for us again?
Yes. Robert F. Kennedy said, "Some people see things as they are and ask why. Other people dream of things as they ought to be and ask why not."
It says a lot. It really does say a lot, Anila.
And, you know, that's the thing, that hate is a cancer. It needs to be addressed. But there are ways that we can address this.
What kind of ways?
There are ways that we can have this kind of conversation, bring people together, and make America see that we all get along. We're all very different, and I may not agree with Pastor, and he may not agree with my viewpoint, but we still get along, and we have respect for each other.
Respect. Respect is the word, isn't it?
That is the word, and that's missing from our national discourse. There's no respect.
Don't you think that's always kind of been the case, though, that this has been sort of a nagging problem? Hate has never sort of gone away. As one gentleman told us, it felt like hate was on vacation and now it's back on the mainland.
I think our speakers made an excellent point. And if you feel how you were grabbed by Pastor Boyd's oratory, we actually have research that shows it's effective. For instance, when Bobby Kennedy spoke the night of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King's murder, he was in Indianapolis. Violence broke out throughout the country, but not there. After 9/11, 6 days, President Bush went to a mosque and said, "Islam is peace." Hate crimes dropped by two-thirds overnight. When we had the Muslim ban proposal, however, in December 2015, 5 days after the San Bernardino terrorist attacks, we saw an increase of 87.5% of hate crimes against Muslims in the next 5 days above the already elevated levels. I don't want to go into a numbers show, but you know what? Words do matter, and we have the research to show that correlation.
So words matter, respect matters, what we tell children matters. It's all tied together, isn't it?
And indifference. Silence is no longer a choice. As human beings, we need to speak up. Can we be silent? We have been silent through the Holocaust, through Kosovo, through the death of Kennedy and Martin Luther King. Can we afford to be silent?
So let's use Jeff and Adam as an example. These guys were unhappy. They didn't like what they were seeing, and they spoke up. And not only did they speak up, they did something about it. That's what we're talking about, isn't it?
For us, it's reacting to what's happening in society. It's speaking up. It's not being a stander buyer, it's getting involved.
I like that word, stander buyer. You just made that up?
I must have.
I guess so. I'll use it, though. I think it's pretty good. Let me get a sort of a final thought. I, you know, hate is a very big subject, and it'd be kind of nice if we could get rid of a word like hate, but you can't get rid of words. And in a country where free speech and the First Amendment is very important, people are going to talk and react, and some are going to say good things and some are going to say not so good things because they can. Because in a country, we have a right to do that, even if it's hateful speech, it's protected by the First Amendment, right? So where it becomes a crime, that's when you're in trouble. But if you're on this side of the line of crime, you're using your First Amendment when you're hateful or you're not hateful. So as we sort of kind of sum this up, why don't each of you sort of give us a thought of what you want people to think about? And let's start with you guys.
I want people to think about how they're different and how other people are different and how that should be celebrated with a society that's constantly reminding us of how we're all different and how this should be dividing. I think we should remind ourselves of the fact that we need to celebrate our humanity every day.
I think people should think about their individuality and celebrating it with each other. I think that there's more ways to love somebody than there is to hate somebody. I think if we're all educating the younger generations more about love and showing them more about love and less of hate, then people will start to have the mindset of welcoming and being a loving person to everybody.
Pastor?
The world environment or the world in arena offers great possibilities, great chances, great opportunities. Every one of us can aspire, every one of us can stretch, every one of us can reach to achieve and to become anything within that spectrum that we desire to be. Each one of us should realize that we are free to get that, but we should never think that we have the right to prohibit someone else's reach or someone else's aspiration to gain that or to become whatever it is they want to do. So now, while we have this opportunity to achieve and to get and to receive, we also have an opportunity to make sure that we leave the environment as free of the encroaches of evil as we possibly can. And evil will certainly embrace itself in under the cloak of hate, because hate brings into the arena something that separates us based upon the ignorance or based upon the greed or the separation that distinguishes itself in race or color or gender or sexual preference or any other thing that separates us, identifies us differently. So each of us have that responsibility to work with each other to embrace this opportunity to keep the world that we have been given to be a better place and help to make the next generation to benefit from it in a greater proportion than we ourselves have.
Now, you and I are about the same age, which means we're the grandpas in the room here. And I don't want to be remiss here, because I think, and I want to know what you think, Pastor, I think that people are more tolerant today than they were when we were growing up. What do you think?
I believe they are. I believe people now are able to have their opinions swayed, to have their minds changed, and they have their positions altered. When I grew up, my parents were a bit more dug into the heels, into the trenches than my generation is. What they said, that's it, and I'm not changing. I'm not changing my mind. And for what reasons, they didn't. And I believe those who embrace hatred, those who embrace racism, and those who embrace the devices that separate people did so with no commitment to change at all. Matter of fact, they're enamored about any opportunity and possibility of change. But this generation, based upon the advancements that we've made in so many different ways, I think can come together now. And we're more tolerant of our children and their opinion than generations of the past were. When I was a child, the adults would say, you are to be spoken to. And you are to be heard as you are spoken to. You're not really given the freedom of expression based on that. That was just the way it went in my generation. But it's changed now. Young people's ideas and young people's involvement, young people's word and young people's opinions are embraced now. And thank God for that, because it brings about a better opportunity and better possibility.
When you and I were little boys, and we're about the same age, 39, give or take, when we were little boys, we lived in areas where there were separated bathrooms.
Correct.
Where there were separated water fountains, where people were less than other people. And before the changes that we see that came in the Johnson administration and came along as a result of civil rights, we could never have had this conversation back then. We could never have been on a public media and talked about this decades ago.
Correct.
And that's why I say we seem more tolerant now. We seem like we can have conversations. We can talk out loud about things we like or we dislike. And is that an improvement, or did that open up Pandora's box for the other side to come up as well?
Really, I think we make no advancement until there's friction and tension. And until there's friction and tension, you remain kind of where you are. If you have an injury, to keep it covered over and keep it in the dark, to not address it, to be silent about it, is to proliferate the life of that injury. But the moment you take the bandage off, expose it to light and fresh air, it begins to heal. We will never begin to heal from our racism, from our separatism, and from the things that divide us based upon our own separation and separate places until we actually come into discussions that bring them to the fore, that we get in environments like we're in today, that classrooms open up their doors and start to talk to their children about separation, about hatred, and when churches and mosques and when synagogues come together and begin to discuss and talk about possibilities and talk about what can be over against what has been and what is now, until we begin to realize that the economy in this country, an economy in the world, is here for everybody. And it's not really right nor fair for us to sit back and watch the smaller part of the population begin to control and begin to monopolize the wealth, because the homelessness and the economic deprivation that we see continues to proliferate. So it's all of our responsibility to talk about it. And hopefully, if we talk about it loudly enough, people in Sacramento, people in San Francisco, people in New York City, people in Washington, D.C., we begin to hear our voice and start to do something about it.
When you talk about friction and tension, is that what we saw in the 60s when Martin Luther King was out there having his I Had a Dream speech on the Mall in Washington, D.C., when there were marches and protests in Selma, that sort of thing? Is that friction and tension?
When they confronted Jim Crow practices, when they confronted oppression, when they confronted the things that marginalized black people in those days and other people of color as it began to emerge, it was the only way to get it done. And they used the platform of a nonviolent approach to get it done. And they said, I'm not going to swing a fist. I'm not going to use a weapon. I'm just going to stand on the part of right, and I'm going to continue to say what is right. And we're going to continue to make this happen. They began to go into board meetings and bring up the race issue. They began to go into churches and bring up the race issue. They began to go into state houses and began to go into federal government and bring up the race issue, because it was out of the tension and the friction that came about as a result of that that brought it to the light. And we then got the 1964 and 65 civil rights bills. We then got the other advancements that we have today. We began to see black people rise up to become board members of major corporations, some of them becoming chairpersons of major corporations. And we began to see the light and the hope and the reality of number 44 being elected president of the United States of America. The first black president. Yes, Barack Obama.
So, Anila?
We've seen some good come out of this hate, too. Muslims and Jews are talking. They're working together. I have so many friends who've just made friends with me because they want to know a Muslim, and then I introduce them to my group of people. Muslims are reaching out to African Americans, working with them. They wouldn't go to a church before. They're going to the churches now. We're working together. So there is some good come out of it. There's a producer who called me and said, you know, all through my grade school years in America, I heard, hey, Jew boy, do this. And he said, that's why I want to work with you. Well, how can I help you? I mean, that wouldn't have happened had we not heard this kind of
We have
direction.
To work together. That's really what exactly. The bottom yeah. line is. Brian?
Prejudice is an attitude, and an attitude consists of three parts. The emotional part, the belief system and observation part, and then the behavioral part. And one of the things that we know is the oxygen that fuels that fire of prejudice, which is an inflexible attitude, and by the way, we've all got it, is to be aware of it and understand that oxygen that fuels it are these negative stereotypes. And when we have them permeating through society, oftentimes by leaders and now in politics, where white nationalism, listen to this, 14% of Americans say whites are under attack and people of color aren't, and 16% are against interracial marriage. That's smaller than what it was back in the early 60s when the number was 61%. But the bottom line is, as Dr. King said, there's no inevitability of this. While the arc bends towards justice, it is brought forward by every one of us. So when there's a stereotype out there in our personal lives, social media, or in leadership, we got to call them out on it, including ourselves sometimes, me included.
I can't remember the last time I had a conversation with people that I've heard quotes from Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and Maya Angelou. Pretty good conversation, everybody. Okay, well, listen, I want to thank everybody for being here. It's Pastor Edgar Boyd from the First AME Church, Anila Ali, who has an organization of Muslim Women Empowerment. Those are the main words, right, in Orange County. Brian Levin from UC San Bernardino.
Cal State.
Thank you. Is this where we all say, ready?
What the hell?
Thanks, everybody, for being with us. See you next time. I've always said that when we can talk and when we can have a conversation about things that can be difficult to talk about, there's always hope. There's always a chance that we can rise above whatever it is that we're feeling, we're talking about. And, you know, that's sort of the way I feel. Good time now to subscribe to our podcast. If you haven't already, just go to iTunes, Google Play, any of the podcast platforms, and jump on in and make some comments. You know, give us 5 stars, that sort of thing. And, you know, keep the hope. See you next time.